Do you think that the time of international law is gone?
Spoiler, the nations aren't united, and the war in Ukraine rages on. Also tonight, since when do wars have civilian torture chambers? Ukraine reveals horrors allegedly committed by a Russian dubbed the Butcher of Bucha. And half a world away from their former lives and homes, Ukrainians by the thousands line up on America's doorstep, but not the doorstep you'd expect. Plus, people call her Charcoal and the new Lady of Death. Her true identity is secret. This female sniper has dozens of kills, and she's not the only woman with Russians in her crosshairs. And then, fleeing for their lives and taking the family pet. What is it about man's best friend that will literally make us risk our lives? It's all ahead tonight on Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield. We begin this hour with breaking news from the Pentagon. The U.S. is sending Ukraine another $100 million worth of defensive missiles, specifically the shoulder-fired javelins that Ukrainian troops have used from the outset to stop Russian tanks in their tracks. The Pentagon says it will continue to, quote, ensure our assistance meets Ukraine's highest priority needs, which is not exactly the message that Volodymyr Zelensky took away from the United Nations Security Council today. Really, though, you can't expect much help from a group that provides your biggest enemy a standing membership and the power to veto anything. Still, Zelensky sharply reminded the council that it has one job. And if it can't do that, it should change its own rules or it should simply just shut down.
Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready to close the UN? Do you think that the time of international law is gone? If your answer is no, then you need to act immediately. The UN Charter must be restored immediately. The UN system must be reformed immediately so that the veto is not the right to die.
Zelensky laid out what he called the most terrible war crime since World War II on full display where the Russians have cleared out. That includes the city of Bucha, where Ukraine's military today released footage of what they say was a torture chamber set up by Russian soldiers to terrorize and kill Ukrainian civilians. The Russian commander who gave those orders, a man now known as the Butcher of Bucha, is said to be this man, Lieutenant Colonel Azatbek Omurbekov, head of the 64th Motorized Rifle Brigade. The Times of London says he is both a decorated soldier and is highly religious. Reportedly, he was blessed by an Orthodox priest just before he shipped out for Ukraine. Elsewhere on the outskirts of Kyiv, more apparent evidence of atrocities. That word you see on the front of that car, that says children, painted on the hood. And the bullet holes are right through the windshield. For their part, the U.S. and Europe are yet again teeing up sanctions, this time on Russian coal and shipping and banking. They're also sending home dozens more Russian diplomats and freezing all Western investment in Russia. And at least one Russian billionaire is apparently now starting to feel the pinch. You've seen him before. Here he is again. New York Post reporting that Roman Abramovich is now trying to borrow millions from his American and British friends so that he can cover his payroll for his staff. And in case you're wondering what his payroll is, it reportedly runs $750,000 a week. Abramovich was sanctioned early on in Europe, but not the United States, because he's supposedly helping broker peace talks. And with that, I want to bring in my News Nation colleague, Tom Negavin, who covered the Ukrainian president's impassioned address to a forum that really should be on his side at the UN, but it's really not that simple, is it, Tom?
No, it's not that simple at all, Ashley, as you well know, and as you laid out so well, It's part of the makeup of the United Nations and the most important, most powerful body there in the UN Security Council. It's five permanent members after its formation at the end of World War II, each given a veto vote, a very important distinction from the other 188 members of the security of the United Nations General Assembly. Russia has veto power here, so any sanctions would have to be sanctioned by Russia in the Security Council, in the General Assembly, never going to happen. And Zelensky laid that out today, along with video, absolutely chilling evidence of atrocities being committed inside Ukraine, absolutely chilling to the members of the Security Council, watching them, listening to him, chiding them for their inaction, understanding the reasons for that, but saying if you can't do something, maybe it's best just to dissolve. Listen.
There is not a single crime that they would not commit there. The Russian military searched for and purposely killed anyone who served our country. They shot and killed women outside their houses when they just tried to call someone who's alive. They killed entire families, adults and children, and they tried to burn the bodies.
And what we're hearing and seeing from Zelensky himself through that video link this morning, Ashley, just remarkable. His translator here at the UN actually having a bit of trouble at times, it seemed, keeping up with the litany of war crimes that he was laying out before the Security Council, begging them, willing them to take action he knows they cannot take without reforming. But maybe it's time, as he suggests, for that kind of reckoning, Ashley.
So Russia has a seat on that all-important Security Council, and surely they laid out whatever their excuses are for what we're all seeing. You know, these aren't our lying eyes. These are our eyes. We can see it. What are they saying?
The ambassador here at the UN, Ashley, along with the Ministry of Defense and the Kremlin spokesman, all on the same page, as you'd expect they would be, but literally using the same words to describe what's going on here. It's a fraud. It's been staged. It's a crude forgery designed to malign the Russian people and the Russian military, falsely accusing them of war crimes, which they have not committed, as they actively work to stall the UN Human Rights Commission from entering areas around Kyiv where human rights abuses and war crimes have undeniably been committed. Zelensky says working right now to clean up their own crime scene.
So part of that crime scene, and I want to ask our control room to put up the pictures that, you know, started to flood in as soon as the Russians left Bucha. Journalists came in and were rolling tape as they were driving, you know, through the streets, and there were bodies littered everywhere. Look at the picture on the left. You can see three boxes that outline three of the dead bodies that are on the streets. And Russia is saying this is a staged crime scene. So now look at the picture on your right. That is a satellite image from March 19th. And those are the three bodies. You can see the landscape. You can see the markers. You can see that those are the actual bodies on March 19th, the date being significant because March 19th was the date the Russians were in control. So there were no Ukrainians there to stage those pictures. Were they able to get these kinds of comparative pieces of evidence up in front of the Security Council today?
They did not today, but UN investigators were given to understand, Ashley, are actually actively looking at all of that, comparing the aerial satellite imagery, imagery from the ground. And they've actually been, appropriately thanking journalists on the ground out there who are risking their lives. You saw some of the images from the inside the UN today that Zelensky brought in to show the members of the Security Council. Absolutely chilling, galling, horrific, like nothing you've really ever seen. And I know you and I share a commonality. We've both been to some pretty horrible parts of the world, some war zones, probably some of the same ones, seen horrible things. Members of the Security Council have never seen anything like what was brought to bear today. They say their investigators are working to uncover even more and, as I say, appropriately thanking journalists on the ground for taking extreme risks to bring those images to light that they can compare to what they're seeing from different angles. There seems to be, as time passes, Ashley, next to no doubt about what's going on there.
Sounds a little hollow if the only answer you have crime after crime after crime is the other guy did it. He blew himself up. He blew up the children. He shot the children. It wasn't us. They shot their own children. They blew up their own children. They staged their own bodies. And after a while, you know, even the Russians are going to have to understand there's only so much lying you can do if it's the same story over and over. Tom, keep watch on that. One more last thought?
You bet. You know, just outrageous. It would be comical if it wasn't so incredibly tragic and so incredibly sad, Ashley.
I think that's exactly the point we're all saying. Again, it's not our lying eyes. Stop asking us not to believe our lying eyes. We're smarter than that. Tom Negevin, live for us at the UN tonight. Thank you for that. You know, the UN says more than 4 million Ukrainians have now fled those horrible places that you've seen in front of, you know, your television screen. And while the vast majority are still actually in Europe, thousands and thousands are trying to reach the United States. And they are pretty darn close. News Nation's Nancy Liu joins me live tonight from Tijuana, Mexico, which is not an entry point commonly used by Eastern Europeans. So, Nancy, just take me there and tell me the story.
Well, we're seeing a lot of new Ukrainian arrivals today. We actually just walked from Tijuana back into the U.S. This is the welcome tent in San Isidro to welcome Ukrainians. It's manned by volunteers, a lot of Ukrainian Americans from all over the country. They've descended here and in Tijuana to help out all of these Ukrainian refugees. In Mexico, thousands of Ukrainians essentially at the gate, but getting through is pretty much a trickle. The call to cross into the U.S. happens multiple times a day at this Ukrainian holding camp just south of the border. It's part of a new semi-official system set up by various churches and humanitarian groups to help refugees funnel through faster.
Basically, we just got all together, started working on a process and created the system just to help ourselves and help the Mexican and American, I guess, system to help them cross the people.
None of this was here. Seriously, I came on Tuesday. There was like maybe 50, 70 people in this building. There was nothing, nothing. It grew like exponentially, like 10 times from what it was.
Ukrainians young and old are now added to a computerized list as soon as they get to Tijuana, which saw less than 1,000 arrivals last week. This week, there are 2,500 and counting. Most have endured dangerous and arduous journeys.
It is hot. Because I lived in the capital of Ukraine, and this is my native time. I'm born in this city,
and now you're living here.
But my people from my country is around me.
Only 150 or so are getting processed daily due to limited customs and border patrol staffing, but that is improving too.
The CBP department, they are really doing their job. I mean, they are increasing the attention that they are giving to people, to Ukrainian people. So I think it's going to be more faster.
With hundreds more arriving every day now, this Tijuana basketball gym has been converted into an emergency shelter. The Benito Juarez Sports Complex is one of several Tijuana facilities providing emergency shelter for more than 1,500 asylum seekers. With a lot more coming, activists plan to open additional shelters.
As long as the U.S. government will wait to make some decisions, we will find a way to feed people and make them safe. This is not American dream. This is the running from war.
And Ashley, in talking to a lot of these Ukrainian asylum seekers, they don't want to stay in the U.S. They do want to get in. They want to be safe. They want to be with their friends and relatives, but they don't want to stay. They hope to go back to Ukraine once the war is over, once it is safe. But it's hard not to notice that most of the people in the camps, young children, 40% young children, and a lot of women.
It's just heartbreaking. But Nancy, I have to be honest, when we were planning to do this back and forth with you, I thought, hold it, why is Nancy in Tijuana? Why isn't Nancy doing this live shot in New York? Because that's usually where you would think Ukrainians would fly and land. So why are they going there?
That would make sense, right? But the word is out among Ukrainians to come to Mexico because they don't require a visa. You can get into Mexico, but it's harder to get into the U.S. But this network set up by a lot of Ukrainian Americans, they are now numbering the Ukrainians. Once they land in Tijuana, they're assigned a number, and small groups are getting through. And it's basically depending on staffing here inside Customs and Border Patrol. They're doing like maybe 100, 150 a day. We're told that staffing is supposed to ramp up in the week, next week or so. So we'll certainly see. But the hope is that people will start getting through faster. But it's a 24-hour operation. People are coming through in small groups. And we hear Customs and Border Patrol, you know, calling for, hey, we'll take another group of 50 or we'll take another group of 10.
Sure,
so
yeah.
It's a very interesting process that's happening here.
I'm confused. So how, because obviously that's a busy border crossing already with other migrants wanting to get across, yeah. Many of them saying they're refugees from political danger. So are they giving a different kind of treatment to the Ukrainians, or are they basically whoever's next in line, tell me your country, tell me your woes? Is that how it's working?
Oh, no. It's only Ukrainians who are getting through because they are exempt from Title 42. And as you know, Ashley, Title 42, it's going to end on May 23rd. So there's a lot of concern here about just thousands of people, migrants, coming to the border and wanting in because Title 42 will be over. And the Ukrainians are worried that they're not going to get through before the 23rd. So they are exempt. They are being allowed in on humanitarian parole. All kinds of church and humanitarian groups are helping them out with housing. A lot of them have spent all their money to get here, and they need the housing. And here's another group coming right now, Ashley. They just
got
through.
Let's go full screen.
We see, yeah. Yeah, this is...
Tell me what's happening.
It looks like a family. This looks to be a family that just got through. We see a baby, and this is the meeting area also for American friends and relatives to come meet their Ukrainian relatives or friends. And
Nancy, I heard clapping. Is there a welcoming group there, or is that just a family meeting another family? Like, who was clapping?
These are volunteers. These are Ukrainian Americans from all over the country. I've met Ukrainians, Americans from Texas, New Hampshire. I actually met a Russian from Texas who came. Oh, here comes another group. People are getting through customs right now, the Customs and Border Patrol. Another young family, it looks to be. And see, they're being welcomed by Ukrainian Americans. They're getting helped out with housing. There's all kinds of food here and supplies for young families. But it's really heartwarming to see just this incredible support network that just came to be pretty much in the last week or so. Because I was here last week, and it was kind of a free-for-all because there was no system.
And Nancy, I don't know, can you stop one of them and ask them if they can talk to us? I don't know if there'll be a language barrier. It's entirely possible this will be a fool's errand.
But if you can get close to one, just to say how it was. Yeah. What number were you? What number? One. They don't speak English, but we're trying.
It's tricky.
1673. Oh, 1473. Okay.
14.
So we're up to number 1473. So that means there are 1,473 down the list. So that's
how many people have been
allowed through. Welcome to America.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
They're happy to be here, obviously. But here we have a young family. Look, the volunteers are always in the neon vests. But we have donuts for the kids. Hello, do you speak English? Not a lot of English
speakers. That's a tricky one, Nancy, yeah. But this is so incredible to watch this actually happening live.
Do you speak English? Can we? Welcome to America. I'm becoming
driving the welcome wagon over here, Ashley. But yeah, it's just incredible.
Nancy, this is amazing. I can't believe we're actually watching it happen right in front of our eyes, live. Yeah. This is amazing.
I know. And
oh, no, I hope we didn't just lose her signal. This is the bugaboos of live TV, but I think we did just have a freeze up on Nancy's live transmission. But if you're just tuning in, this is one of those moments you can't expect on live television. Not the fact that it froze. The fact that, as Nancy was telling me about what had been happening all day at the Tijuana border, that Ukrainians can get an easier visa into Mexico than they can into the United States. So they're going to Mexico and coming across the southern border. And all of a sudden, applause broke out. And so Nancy started explaining what was going on behind her as fresh new families, you know, who have just escaped the atrocities of Ukraine were welcomed into your country. Wow, that was pretty magical. Lots of little children, welcoming committees. And one of the questions I actually had for Nancy, she was answering live for me. I was going to ask her, how many Americans have come down to help? There's a huge Ukrainian community in this country. How many of them have said, I'm going to welcome, you know, these new arrivals who need all the love and support they can get? But hats off to Nancy Liu. What a great job she just did. And I'm so sorry that our signal broke up, but that is what happens when you're dealing with technology. I have a totally different story I'm about to tell you, and it is nothing short of fascinating. A tale of two snipers, one Ukrainian, one Russian, both of them women, both of them lethal. These ladies of death have dozens and dozens of kills between them. After the break, we'll tell you what makes them so elite and how they're following a long tradition of female killing machines. Welcome back. Code name Charcoal. That's the nickname for a sniper who's become a national hero in Ukraine for amassing a long list of kills. Charcoal's true identity is unknown, but there is one piece of information about this killer that has surprised a lot of people. Ukraine's elite sniper, Charcoal, is a woman. And even though she's famous, these are the only known photos of her. She is dressed in camouflage with the bottom of her face covered, and everything else that we know about her comes from the Ukrainian military. According to her file, she joined the Ukrainian Marines back in 2017. She spent years fighting pro-Russian separatists in Donetsk and Luhansk, and she retired from the military back in January of 2021. But she re-enlisted just before the Russian invasion. She is now serving on the front lines with the 35th Infantry Brigade. The Ukrainians have also released the text of a speech that she made to her fellow troops. I'm going to read it to you in part. It says, "We must take them all out. These people are not human beings. Even the fascists were not as vile as these orcs. We must defeat them." If you're like me, I didn't know what orcs meant, but it is the evil army in the Lord of the Rings, which is appropriate because secret identities and code names and elite snipers and everything else in this real life story seems like something out of a book or a movie, and yet it's not as rare as you might think. Russia also had its own elite female sniper fighting for them. And it's the woman on the left. Her name is Irina Starikova. She's 41 years old, and she's been racking up kills since 2014 in Donetsk. So that means that she and Charcoal were likely serving in the same part of the country at the same time and maybe even had each other in their scopes. Irina's code name is Bagheera, taken from the Black Panther character in Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book. And she is just as deadly. According to Ukraine, she's responsible for at least 40 kills, including civilians. But that tally has likely come to an end because she was captured by the Ukrainians last month after she was wounded and left to die on the battlefield by her fellow Russian soldiers. Yes, that's what they did. They left her behind. She was alive. The Ukrainians say they gave her medical treatment and are presumably still holding her as a prisoner of war. Ms. Starikova is married to another sniper, Alexander Ogrenich, whose nickname is the Dragon. He claims to have killed 100 people. Both of these two are parents of two kids. Kind of wondering if she's going to be a bargaining chip down the line somewhere. She is an elite warrior that you would think Russia would probably really want to have back. But her fellow soldiers did leave her there to die, so might she defect? After the break, I'll be joined live by someone who knows all about these women warriors and how the ones fighting for Ukraine might just have history on their side. That's next. Welcome back to Banfield. Two snipers, one Russian, one Ukrainian, both incredibly deadly, and both ladies. They racked up the kills during the war in Ukraine, but their eventual fates have been very different. Ukraine's sniper, the one on the right, is known as Charcoal, and she's still out there, presumably racking up more Russian kills and being hailed as a hero. Her Russian counterpart, however, Irina Starikova, codename Bagheera, was captured last month by Ukrainian soldiers after her fellow Russian soldiers left her on the battlefield to die. And while female snipers might seem unusual to many Americans, these two women are actually carrying on a tradition that dates back decades. For more on that, I want to bring in Dr. Lori Stoff. She's a historian who specializes in Russian and East European history, gender studies, and war and society. Dr. Stoff, thanks for joining me tonight. I cannot wait to ask you a gazillion questions about these two women, but also the legacy that they leave behind and that they're following. It's not that unusual, is it, for Ukrainians and Russians to have female snipers?
No, it's not. Actually, there's a long history of this in both countries, which were united for quite some time under the Russian Empire and the Soviet empires. Women participated in warfare sporadically throughout history, mostly disguised as men. But in the 20th century, we have examples of first in the First World War, Russia recruiting the very first all-female combat units in 1917 with about 5,000 women. And then in World War II, in the Soviet armed forces, there were almost 1 million women who served, over 350,000 of them in combat positions.
Wow. I mean, when you compare it to, you know, women in combat in the U.S., it just seems like a whole other world. But, you know, I was inspired when I learned about Charcoal, the Ukrainian sniper, whose other names are secret, to look back a little bit. And I came across Lyudmila Pavlichenko. And when you look at all of the stats that Charcoal has, they're nothing compared to Ms. Pavlichenko, who is considered the most successful female sniper of all time. Tell me a little bit about Lyudmila.
Well, Lyudmila Pavlichenko is actually Ukrainian. She served in the Red Army, the Soviet armed forces during World War II. She fought Nazis. She has 309 confirmed kills. So that's a spectacularly high number of kills. She was celebrated as a national heroine in the USSR, but she was also touted in the West. She came to the United States and toured with Eleanor Roosevelt, gave speeches around the country to help promote the Allied war effort. American folk singer Woody Guthrie even wrote a song about her called Miss Pavlichenko.
Wow. But here's the thing that really got my goat, Dr. Stoff. While she was on her American tour, a whole bunch of the reporters who, you know, were men back there for the most part, back then, they asked her a lot of questions about her skirt length and her weight.
Yes, and why she didn't wear very much makeup or any makeup at all. And yes, they were very critical of her physical appearance, which perturbed her quite a bit. She shamed them, though, by saying, well, I was out killing Nazis. What were you doing?
Seriously, I'm so glad you told me that, because all I kept thinking was, I really hope she looked at these guys and said, you know, I can't kill you from 1,000 meters. You know, like I was hoping she'd have some good comeback. So I'm glad you told me that. Okay, then there's this other piece of research that I came across that I wanted you to tell me about. And there, someone called, like a group called the Night Witches, who were like flying aces at a time when you wouldn't have expected women to be flying aces.
Yes. So there were about 200,000 women in the Soviet air defenses during World War II. So there were a number of women who served as pilots, as navigators, And the women who were termed night witches by the Germans, that was actually a derogatory term used to describe them, were the women who were involved in the most dangerous night bombing raids behind German lines. And they were incredibly successful. And again, they were touted as great heroes of the Soviet Union for their actions.
Yeah, I don't know if that one on the far right has a cigar in her mouth, but she looks pretty badass. And P.S., they gave them the crappiest equipment. They gave them, like, planes from the 1920s that were so slow that the Nazis had to slow down their bombers to catch them. But what I found out about them I thought was remarkable. They used that deficiency to their benefit. They could glide. And because they could glide long distances in these old, you know, planes, they were able to glide through the night skies and drop bombs without people seeing and hearing them, right?
Yes, that's true. So they definitely were highly skilled pilots. They had a very high level of technical skill. They were very good at their jobs. And despite the deficiencies of their equipment, they were able to overcome them and carry out a number of very successful bombing raids behind enemy lines.
Sisters, I love it. Okay, so the other question I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you're going to have the answer to this or not, because I feel like we're living in a time that doesn't have a template for the kind of warfare that we're seeing. But, you know, Irina Starikova, the Russian, you know, sniper that they caught, the one that was left for dead by her Russian mates, other soldiers, what will happen to her? What is the likelihood that she will live or ever be traded or make it back to see whatever family she may have left?
So interestingly enough, Starikova is not Russian. She is a Serbian national, and her husband is Belarusian. So they are not Russian nationals. They've gone to fight for Russia. Serbia and Belarus are allied with Russia in this conflict. It seems to me that they're fighting more as mercenaries, and as you probably well know, Russia is relying very heavily on mercenary troops, like from the Wagner Group. So I don't know if the Russians will consider her to be a valuable player and will do much to try to get her released. I don't know that the Ukrainians have much use for her, but I do believe
really?
That they... I do believe they will buy.
No, listen, Dr. Stoff, I thought that maybe if she was Serbian, the Ukrainians would say, you're working for us now. Simple.
Well, I guess that's possible. They just work for the highest bidder, or she might have ideological alliance or allegiance to Russia. I can't really say what her motivations are.
I am so glad that you chose the discipline that you did, because you're absolutely perfect for this story tonight. Thank you so much. Really interesting stuff.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Lori Stoff joining us tonight with, like, what a great couple of details. I'm staying on this one. I'm going to follow this mercenary and see what happens with her. In the meantime, you have seen the footage. Millions of refugees fleeing from Ukraine, taking only what they can carry. So it is hard not to notice how many chose to take their pets. Why is that? Well, coming up, the man who literally wrote the book on why we would risk our lives for our dogs. It is the story of your dog, and it's next. You have minutes to decide. Run for your life, take only what you can carry. That decision has played out millions of times as Ukrainians flee the war zone, and as picture after picture has proven, many decided to take their pets, sometimes small and manageable pets, sometimes large, no matter the burden. What binds people so closely to their dogs that they'd make a decision over food and water and other vital possessions? Brandon McMillan is the author of The Story of Your Dog, and he knows a lot about that question and what bonds your dog to you. His new book is all about the mysteries of each breed and how to unlock them to have a better relationship with your pet. And Brandon has brought a little friend along, I think, named Coda. Yeah, there's Coda. Is it a flat coat retriever?
Flat coat retriever, yes.
What a cutie. So you're the perfect person to ask because you know everything about pets and the connection between pets and owners. I want to ask you a little bit about what we're seeing in these pictures. Are you surprised at the number of refugees who have chosen to leave with their pets, even the big dogs that require, like, care, attention, food, and sometimes being carried?
I'm not surprised at all. Wouldn't you take your own dog?
I would want to, but if I had little children, I would have to make a terrible Sophie's Choice decision, and you know what that decision would have to be, right? If you can't care for your kids because you're looking after a 68-pound dog.
Well, you just hit the nail on the head. Pets nowadays are not our pets anymore. They're our children. I always say the pets of modern times, originally they started out in the wild and they went to the farm and eventually they went to the backyard and eventually they came into the house and eventually they made it onto the couch and now they're in our beds. Our pets are not pets anymore. They're now our family members. And so it's no surprise when I'm seeing these images in Ukraine of people carrying their pets, whether they're 10 pounds or even 50 pound dogs, you know, on their shoulders. So yeah, I mean, if I had to do the same thing, all my pets would be strapped on my back. I don't care how many.
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same way. I think this might be the first war that I've covered, and I've covered more than I care to mention, where I've seen this phenomenon, where I've seen the refugees leaving with their pets. And it might be more of a Western phenomenon, being that Ukraine is European, than, say, Asian, where fewer people tend to have dogs as pets. Maybe that's the phenomenon. Do you think that might be at play?
Possibly, but, you know, as time goes on, I mean, even I don't care whatever culture around the world, we're starting to see the evolution of pets are no longer farm animals. They're starting to become, you know, family dogs. They're starting to become more, you know, family members. So, you know, in fact, it's amazing, especially in the last, 100 years, we're starting to realize that pets, specifically dogs, can actually detect things like cancer. They can detect blood sugar drops from diabetics. They can detect seizures coming on. So, you know, we're not looking at them as pets anymore. We're not looking at them as dogs anymore. We're looking at them as vital family members that can potentially save our lives physically and emotionally.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I've been broadcasting for 34 years, and this is the first time I've always had a dog in the studio. So there's a little secret. Atlas is in every studio. If he happens to see Coda, there might be some barking, so I'll just give you fair warning. Let me ask you, because I have you, I want to ask about something in your book that I just thought was... There he is. That's Atlas. That's Atlas and me on my front step, and I'll tell you what I... Don't think I've loved any dog more than this dog. He's so cute. I want to ask you about the breeds of dogs and what we think we can get our dogs to do and why we shouldn't think that should be so easy.
Well, you have to remember every breed out there, there's no breed that was a fluke. Every breed was bred for an original purpose hundreds and thousands of years ago. And so what I see time and again is people, they're trying to mold and they're trying to shape their dog against the dog's genetics. For example, it's very common to see, like, terriers, for example. Terriers were single-handedly bred to exterminate vermin before we ever had exterminators. Exterminators only became a real thing in the past 100 years, and so the terriers technically lost their jobs that they had for hundreds of years. So now we've turned these terriers into pets, but every genetic in that dog's body, Coda's tired here, by the way, every genetic
okay.
in that dog's
Coda
body
can
is
have
still
a
saying,
can have
I need
nap.
To... But every genetic in that terrier's body is still saying, I need to go out, find a rat, and go exterminate it. So we have to be understanding of the dogs we have in our house, not the dog we want to have. Every dog has a story. Every dog was bred for a specific purpose, and that's exactly what my book covers. And I try to really itemize not only the breeds, but the groups. For example, the herding groups, the terriers, the hounds, and these groups all were bred for a purpose. And it's much easier meeting your dog in the middle, understanding your dog was bred for a purpose, and understanding that maybe their shortcomings that you find, you know, to be annoying actually is fully wrapped up in their genes. So this is exactly what my book is about. And so it's so far, everyone, I mean, I've gotten rave reviews. It's only been out just one day. And I've gotten a lot of people that skip to their chapter. And all the reviews that I'm hearing right now, they're like, I had no idea my dog was bred for this, you know, 500 years ago.
So, Brandon, let me ask you this. The biggest mistake that dog owners make in choosing a breed, and then, of course, which breed is the most common mistake for families or seniors or singles? Give us a little bit of advice in these last minutes.
Well, the biggest mistake I see is people choosing a dog that goes against a human's lifestyle. For example, if you're a very mellow person and you never leave the house, I would highly recommend you don't get a herding breed, for example. Herding breeds are high energy. If I had to put their energy level on a scale of 1 to 10, I would say it's an 11. Furthermore, if you have an apartment, don't get a high energy dog. People don't think about their lifestyle and what the dog's natural genetics are. So you need to think about your own lifestyle, what you actually do on a daily basis, and that's the kind of dog, that's the kind of breed you should get. There's a lid for every jar out there, so everyone's lifestyle has a specific breed or a breed type. And this is the most common thing that I see. So, and furthermore, you have to think about, when it comes to families, there are certain dogs. This doesn't go to any specific breed, but it goes to a specific personality. You might want to be careful if you have kids, and there's a lot of small dogs out there that simply just don't like kids. So this is the whole point of the shelter system. You can actually bring your family there, and you can talk to the people at the shelter system, and the people at the shelter say, you know what, this little dog right here, it doesn't really like little toddlers, but it's much better with, you know, kids that are maybe 12 and over. So this is the whole point of the rescue world. You have to consult with them because they're the ones who know these dogs the best.
That is smart advice, and there's more smart advice in this book right here. It's called The Story of Your Dog. Brandon McMillan, thank you so much for being here tonight. Really appreciate it. And thank you, Coda.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, if you don't already know it, dogs are the most popular pet in America. But what American city is the most dog-loving of all? What city has the highest number of dogs per resident? Coming up, we'll throw you a bone. Before the break, we asked you to guess what U.S. city has the most dogs per resident. And if you guessed one of our more populated human cities like New York, L.A., or Chicago, you would be barking up the wrong tree. Pretty funny. Here's a hint, though. The city is known for its coffee and for the giant needle. It's Seattle. Seattle's got 264 dogs for every 1,000 residents, and that is more than one dog for every 4 Seattle citizens. Following Seattle in the puppy dog population, Miami has 187 per 1,000 people, and then San Francisco has 140 puppy dogs per 1,000 people. That is it for us, and it's time now to turn things over to Leland Vittert and Rutabay Shabazi for their special report on Ukraine. And I think I understand during this show you guys are going to be doing the story about Elon Musk joining the board of Twitter. Mm-hmm. There's so many things that I'd like to ask him, for the edit button. You know, the edit button? Have you always wanted the edit button?
Yeah, but the thing
is... Of all the things to ask for.
No, but the thing is, if you have an edit button, the people who retweeted the original post then have inadvertently retweeted whatever was edited. Isn't that the argument against it?
It's the number one question,
confused.
It's the number one question among Twitter users is, can you please give us an edit button for our typos? And if you read some of the Twitter responses, it's amazing. I mean, there's some very simple solutions. Yeah, just a 30-second edit button, and then after that, it closes out, and there's always a little mark that says edited. It seems really simple to me, and I don't know. The only reason I suggest it, Leland, is because that is the number one question of American Twitter users.